This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
You know, I've been doing this show now for 24, 25 years, and they still let me do it every week, thanks to you. And wherever you are on the planet, I think you are going to be as enthused about the credits of my guest on The God Show, our guest, yours and mine, because as a result of the fact that just a very, very short time ago, the world was stunned at the savagery that happened with the attack on Israel by various members of Hamas. And we're going to find out more about Hamas, and we're going to be finding out about the whys and wherefores and why somebody would attack a country as well-armed as Israel, and why now, after all this time, well, why would I ask anybody else but Rabbi Bonnie Capel, not only a female rabbi, associate rabbi to the Temple Chai. And I'm not doing chai jokes. I'm not doing that as a greeting. That is my attempt at Hebrew.
That was perfect.
Retired Army Colonel Chaplain Capel was the first female rabbi in the United States military. Is that right?
That is correct.
Wow. Wow. That in itself just is a stunning honor, because I don't have to tell you, having spent something like 28 years in the military, you know how slow things go and how deliberate decision-making is when it comes to, do we really want a female rabbi? Yeah, we want a rabbi, but it's a girl. You know, what are we going to do about this? Well, let's take a break and have another meeting sometime. Huh?
Yes, sir.
No, you don't say sir to an enlisted man when you're a colonel. My first question, though, is to you as an Army officer, having served in the Middle East and elsewhere, serving as a rabbi, I'm asking you questions as a colonel and as a rabbi. How could this attack by Hamas on Israel have happened? You must have asked yourself this when you heard the news.
Not only have I asked myself that question, I think it is a question that many, many are asking. Israel has had a secure, protective fence that has stood for decades, and for Hamas have been able to breach that fence as they did is relatively incomprehensible. And I would imagine that the wise minds in the Israel Defense Forces are already trying to understand how that occurred, and clearly to repair the defenses and ensure that never, ever, ever again could such an unimaginable thing occur.
And the Palestinian side, with no reflection on the nationality, but the Palestinian side of that part of the Middle East is not the most technically sophisticated military or society in the world. And that's why virtually everybody, Jew or Gentile, said, they what? No, no, wait, Israel, with all of the technology that they have and the intelligence, sometimes putting ours to shame, how could they not have known? And you still don't have an answer yet.
I don't think that anyone has the answer to that question. I think the answers are only beginning to emerge. And Israel has been prepared to defend against missiles from the sky. There was not the preparation for tractors and motorcycles to enter Israeli towns and villages, go door to door, knock down the doors of safe rooms and drag out non-combatants, men, women, children, grandmothers.
Babies, grandmothers,
infants.
Yeah. The atrocities were unthinkable at any time. But at this period of time, when I suppose we innocently, I think much of the world simply thought, well, you know what? The really bad stuff is over now. The bad stuff is over. Now we have to decide, is it possible to have a duality of governments and religions? And let's figure this thing out, even though it's taken a long time.
I think there was clearly a political movement in that direction. There were serious talks going on between Saudi Arabia and the State of Israel. The United Arab Emirate has entered into peaceful accord. And what it seems to have happened is that this was threatening to the arch enemy of Israel, Iran, who were very supportive of the Hamas movement to disrupt that peace process.
Okay, what is Hamas? Please help us understand the various elements that go into terrorism.
Hamas is a terrorist organization which is opposed to the existence of the State of Israel. I do believe, Pat, I think you were alluding to it, that if you look around the world, the people of the world, for the most part, want to live in peace with each other. If you look at the lives of Israelis at the moment of this incursion, there were young people at a concert in the south of Israel who were dragged away, women who were raped in the presence of the bodies of their friends, carried off in jeeps. What do we all really want? To go to a concert, to go to a park, to visit with our friends. And Hamas is dedicated, clearly, to disrupting the life that we all, for the most part, long for.
But it's a politician's dream to have had that kind of, even though it's clear that it's going to be relatively short-lived, the dream that we did this to mighty Israel, and they, Hamas, that is a political group.
Absolutely. And sadly, they and their allies are rejoicing in the streets over this catastrophic horror.
Are the allies, I mean, a society that was Persia and is now Iran, over the thousands of years of existence, can they really celebrate the rest of the world seeing what has happened?
It's incomprehensible to me and maybe to you, but yes, there is celebration in the streets in some communities.
Perhaps in some communities, but not Saudi Arabia anymore, because they said guardedly, yeah, let's make nice. And the United Arab, some of the elements that used to be a part of the folks that Israel was constantly concerned about invading or attempting to invade, they're now kind of shaking hands over business deals.
Absolutely. Peace is the future. It's the way. It's the hope. It's the dream. It's what we all long for.
Could the recent political unrest in Israel, unusual in itself, Mr. Netanyahu, not necessarily the next door neighbor of every Israeli, there was some real conflict there politically about the Knesset, their parliament, and the success of his attempt at once again becoming the prime minister. Success for him, but unrest in the streets.
There has been an undermining of the power and authority of the Supreme Court. And as U.S. citizens, I think we all appreciate the importance of the distinction between the executive, the judicial and what in Israel would be the Knesset.
Yeah, Congress, Senate, you do what the Supreme Court tells you.
The parliament, as it's called in Israel. We appreciate and respect the importance of that distinction, and that has recently been undermined in Israel, and it has caused great dissension in the streets. But I can tell you, if Hamas was looking to play up that dissension, their actions have caused the exact opposite, because what they have done is bring the people of Israel together, of course, in one united front to bring the international Jewish community and many of the United States and Israel's allies together. There's no defense for the actions of Hamas. There's no moral equivalence for a military operation undertaken by combatants and the terror that has been inflicted on innocent civilians.
If Hamas is not smart enough to recognize its own suicidal destruction with this kind of activity, in the eyes of the world too, not just Israel, isn't Iran a much more sophisticated society, and they continue to be suspiciously involved?
I cannot second guess the political thinking and the strategic concept of the Iranian government.
You can tell us what you think.
What I can say is that a takeaway is never to underestimate the intensity of human capacity for evil. And it's just a sad reality from the get-go. I'm thinking about the book of Genesis, the earliest chapters of Genesis, where we read that if you do right, God is with you. But if you do evil, sin, we read in the text, couches at the door. We're each born with a Yetzer HaTov, a capacity for good, and a Yetzer HaRa, a capacity for evil. And we each have the opportunity, it's what it is to be human, to make those choices. And sadly, there are those who choose evil.
And so Israel is in the process right now, in the last 24 hours, of arming and giving uniforms to 310,000 additional people, because virtually everybody that is at least of the appropriate age in Israel is or has been in the military, right?
Every Israeli citizen, male and female, serves in the military for 2 or 3 years and remains in the reserve component until the age of 60.
Now, Rabbi Bonnie Kappel didn't happen to be living in Israel at the time that she enlisted, but she spent 28 years in the United States Army.
38 years.
Oh, for crying out loud.
1978 until 2016.
Well, whatever happened to those 10 years that I found?
It goes fast, Pat.
Wow. Well, all right, 38 years then. We're talking about professional, retired colonel now, with a proud background. And by the way, the military college, was it the War College?
The Army War College.
Where is that located?
Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania.
You said it immediately, as if you didn't even have to stop and try to remember.
It was a major moment in my life. I spent a little over 2 years as a proud, struggling student at the U.S. Army War College.
You have to be accepted, though, right?
Very proud graduate, yes. Very few graduate. Very few are accepted. Of those who are accepted, there's a significant number who don't stay with the curriculum. And certainly as a chaplain, there are not a lot of chaplains at the War College, and a handful of rabbis who've ever had that opportunity.
How many women rabbis?
Women rabbis, zero.
You are, once again, I just think of the vast experience that you've had in leadership positions in the military. What parts of the world?
I had the privilege of going twice to Iraq for the holiday of Passover to celebrate and bring Passover Seders to far-flung, remote, forward operating bases, celebrating with as few as two or as many as 40 service members and contractors throughout the country of Iraq. I was in Kuwait more times than I can count for Passover as well. I did two tours in Afghanistan for Hanukkah. And you know that the holiday of Hanukkah is 8 days. So I would travel through Afghanistan and joke with the soldiers, it's the 9th day of Hanukkah, it's the 11th day of Hanukkah, because in the military you celebrate when the rabbi is there, not necessarily on the exact date.
And they didn't necessarily have calendars where they were.
Of the holiday, but it was an incredible, incredible privilege and so deeply appreciated by our deployed service members. One young woman in Iraq after the Seder said to me, it's almost like being at home.
Must break your heart, though, when you read now about where Afghanistan has gone, particularly to women.
Exactly so. The minute that we left, my heart broke as I watched the exit from, it was Bagram Air Base. I remember being there and watched people begging and pleading to get onto those planes. And I knew in that moment what the consequences were going to be for the women of Afghanistan. From such a place of hope and emergence into liberation and into the 21st century, to be shunted aside the way they have, and to think about the blood and treasure that we expended that sadly, in a way, feels like it was for naught.
How long can we stay in countries that we have, for lack of a better term, occupied, who rapidly seem to be able to change back to the way they were?
We're still in Germany. We're still in Korea. I think the United States, based on the strength of our military and the strength of the American people, has a responsibility to support freedom in the world.
And in Vietnam, the French left, and we came in, and we're sorry. It's a remarkable repetitive history, though, that goes on. But you have those memories, and they're good memories, are they not?
They're good memories for me of being able to bring a few moments of peace and joy and comfort to those who were sacrificing their time with their families and loved ones to protect the cause of, we might say, freedom and justice for all.
Tell me about spending time in Israel.
I have been to Israel on 5 occasions. Look forward to getting back there as soon as possible, even more so now because it feels extremely important to me that the people of Israel know that the American Jewish community is with them at this terrible, terrible moment. My first trip to Israel was in 1973 as a teenager myself. I went on a 6-week tour in 1981. I led a tour for American Jewish teenagers, and I've gone back a couple of times on professional tours. I had the opportunity to take my late husband and my two young daughters for 2 months to live in Jerusalem when I had a little time off from one of my congregations to do some personal study there.
2 months. What an extraordinary experience. And then what an opportunity beyond the normal vacation time to be able to assimilate into an area.
Absolutely.
When I was in Israel visiting as a little Irish Catholic guy, I was really enhanced in so many ways, and I was enhanced by the history, and I was enhanced by every element of the tours that we had, and of the levels of education. I got a chance to do some interviews on the campuses of David Ben-Gurion University and a couple of other higher education places that were stunning to me, the successes that they've had in developing scientists and attorneys and doctors. But I was also quite taken with a number of Palestinian Israelis. And during this terrible period of time over there now, I was instantly taken back to the time that I had an opportunity to spend some time with the people who were Israelis, who were living there, had raised their families in Israel. They happened to be Palestinians. And it seemed as if they were treated, I don't know equally, but they were treated with conviviality, and they were treated with respect.
There are Arab members of the Knesset. There are Arab citizens serving in the Israel Defense Forces. I saw a moment from this latest war of an Arab citizen being attacked and killed by Hamas while screaming, "I'm Arab, I'm Arab."
Oh.
As I recall, they were picking vegetables in their garden and attacked and killed.
Indiscriminately. But there are, as you said, not only members of the parliament, voting members of the government of Israel, but very influential business people, too, who are Palestinians living in Israel. A lot of people think that all of the Palestinians are in the Gaza area. And in spite of the fact that there is a wall, that Palestinians are not allowed in Israel. That's not true.
Palestinian and Israeli children go to school together. Mm. Their parents work together. They socialize. They marry. They create families of their own.
Will they now? What about those people who have lived as friends and neighbors and who now have to face the reality of what happened? What do they do?
Pat, I'm a rabbi. I'm in the hope and prayer business. I have to hope and pray that the power of good will always inevitably, ultimately triumph.
Tell our audience, wherever they are in whatever religion or none, it's a part of their lives. Talk about your services after the attack on Israel and the holiday that you were celebrating and the dancing. Please talk about dancing with the Torah and making the decision whether to or not.
Yes, thank you. So this past Friday night, the community at my congregation, Temple Chai, gathered in mass with a live band to celebrate the holiday of Simchat Torah, rejoicing with the Torah. It is an incredibly joyous holiday, in part because while we joke for many other Jewish holidays, what's the focus of the holiday? They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. Simchat Torah is not about they tried to kill us. It's simply about the joy of learning, the joy of study, the celebration of this gift of the Torah, the five books of Moses, that we read every word every year, beginning with Genesis through Deuteronomy. And then we're so excited that we have a celebration dancing with the Torah scrolls. And we literally open the entire Torah scroll from beginning to end around the sanctuary. We read selections from the text. We read the last word. We say a brief blessing, and we immediately read the first word again, because our study, our engagement with the text is continuous. In Jewish tradition, many observant Jews don't use electricity, don't watch television on the Sabbath, and that is, my personal practice is not to watch television on Shabbat. So I came home from services on Friday night all high on the celebration and the dancing and getting ready for services the next morning, where the joy would continue. And when I woke up, I saw the text messages on my phone. Incredulity. And drove to the temple for our Saturday morning service, and immediately looked at my sermon notes that I had so diligently and thoughtfully prepared, and said, it's not that it's meaningless, but this is irrelevant in this moment. This is not what I need to say. This is not what people need to hear. And I had to rewrite my whole sermon in about 20 minutes, which was a big challenge, but just to express my heartfelt feelings in that moment, as we began the book of Genesis, to say, when we read the story of creation, it says, and God began to create, and the world was, in Hebrew, tohu vavohu. It was chaos and void. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And in that morning, in that moment, I felt like there was chaos and destruction then, and there's still chaos and destruction now, and we are not experiencing the light of God's face, as we say in the priestly blessing. We are experiencing the light of rockets lighting up the sky. That is also the time of the year, Pat, where we change in our prayers related to nature to prayers for rain. We thank God. It becomes the rainy season in Israel. And of course, as we know, in an agricultural society, in any human society, we are dependent for our food and our survival on rains in their season. So the Jewish community around the world at that moment was changing our prayers to prayer for rain.
And this community, by coincidence, this community being at least this part of Arizona, when I was there, I was really surprised at how close topographically the two areas are.
It's a very similar climate. And I just couldn't help but reflect on saying prayers for rain while our Israeli cousins and family were experiencing the rain of rockets and not the life-giving rain and the light that we all hope for.
Did the congregation dance?
Oh, no. There was no dancing.
Some did.
I read
that some had making an extremely difficult decision. Some decided that we still must celebrate these other things while that's going on.
It's a challenging decision, and every rabbi, every community had to make the decision that felt right and appropriate to them. I'm currently immersed in preparing for this Friday night, for the Sabbath. And the Sabbath is every week a time of joy. And certainly at Temple Chai this Friday night, our joy will be vastly diminished. It won't be a service of mourning. We will include many of the traditional prayers. But as I was reading through the liturgy this morning, preparing that service, phrases were emerging from the page. Of course, first and foremost, the prayers for peace. I also looked at the verse that said, those who love God hate evil. And that is just powerfully meaningful to me right now.
Hamas terrorists, I think, virtually on a planet-wide basis, the Hamas terrorists have ignored virtually all the standards of warfare, if there are actually standards of warfare. But the Geneva Convention and a number of others said, no, even when you get to this, you can't do that. And you can't do that to hostages. You can't do that to babies. You can't do this. Those are savage, inhuman things. And I asked another rabbi what it is that Israel can possibly do. And he said, there is a real problem because they will not resort to the same kinds of practices. So they must be, particularly because of hostages, it is an inherent part of their moral belief in the military that you may not harm hostages. So, wow, talk about a barrier. Is there anything really to the idea that there is a holy war?
There, first of all, a war of defense. Mm-hmm. Judaism, I think significantly, is not a pacifist tradition. And the right of self-defense is integrated into Jewish thinking. We are not obligated to give up our own lives, to sacrifice our own lives. We are entitled to defend ourselves. So I would say, yes, a holy war is a war of self-defense. You may have studied with other rabbis that there's sometimes a mistranslation in the Ten Commandments. The commandment, thou shalt not murder, is sometimes mistranslated as thou shalt not kill. And we look at that important distinction between murder and killing. Murder is the taking of innocent life. Killing is always tragic, but sometimes sadly necessary.
If I'm defending my family.
If I'm defending my family, if I'm defending my homeland, we never want to rejoice in the suffering that is a necessary part of war. And we hope and pray for a time of universal peace, for a messianic age, as it were. But another verse that struck me liturgically this morning was Psalm 29. God will give strength to the people. God will bless the people with peace. And it has always seemed significant to me that strength comes before peace. Peace can only come from a place of strength.
There's some Methodists and Lutherans and Catholics that are listening right now saying, oh, well, wait a minute. We have some of those same things in our Bible.
Funny about that. And, you know, it's the Quran also includes the Hebrew scriptures, as you were. So we have so much in common. Most of the world, as I said, wants to live in peace with each other. One of the things that I think is beautiful in the Talmud is it says, the righteous of all faiths have a share in the world to come. We don't believe that you have to be Jewish in order to be saved. We think Catholicism is great for the Catholics, and Buddhism is great for the Buddhists, and Islam is great for Muslims. We're not about trying to convert the world. what we want is for people to connect with the godly within them.
The truth is, having been raised most of my life around a lot of Jewish people, if I wanted to convert to Judaism, you don't even encourage it. You have this totally different attitude rather than embracing it. Oh, listen, oh, you want to be one of us? No, come over here and let us encourage you. You don't do that. You tell people how tough it is to be a Jew.
Well, and I think we're right. It's, you know, that at no moment more so than right now is it evident the pain and suffering that has been part of Jew. Why? We ask converts that to this day, like, why would you want to take this on? And do you understand that you are taking this on by choosing to join the Jewish people?
And suffering anti-Semitism, which seems to not only never go away, but at this period of time, I don't know that it is on some kind of perpetual rise. I don't even know why it's happening. I don't know why it ever happened. But a recent gathering to protest the war in Phoenix was guarded by a number of members of Phoenix law enforcement, and they were guarding the people who were making that statement because they didn't want anti-Semites to make a statement in opposition to the fact that here's a gathering of Jews. Oh, how dare they? How dare they? How dare they? Over and over and over again through centuries. Why? Please explain to me the current attitude of anti-Semitism in so many different elements of our society.
It is indisputable that global anti-Semitism is on the rise. In our own country, there have been an increase in anti-Semitic threats, in bomb threats, in anti-Semitic...
Why? What did you do? What did you do to make the rest of the folks mad?
So, that is an excellent question that many have struggled to answer. There's an old and sad joke. Guy is sitting on the subway reading the newspaper, cursing the Jews. The Jews, the Jews, it's all the fault of those GD Jews. And the guy sitting next to him says, yet, the Jews and the bicyclists. And the first guy says, why the bicyclists? And the second guy says, why the Jews?
Boom.
And that is the question that we have struggled with. There are a number of answers that academics have proposed. You talked about Jewish education, the commitment to the value of Jewish education that you saw when you yourself were in Israel. Jews have always set the highest priority on education, and as a result of that value, Jews have flourished in every country historically that has given them opportunity. And I think that that economic success is somewhat a source of jealousy that can lead to anti-Semitism.
By the way, please excuse me, because when a little Irish guy interrupts this kind of profound Jewish philosophizing, I have to do so only with the thought that you might consider this to be a value on the heels of what you were just talking about, education, Jewish education. I have often been asked by people who are sports fans, if they really are sports fans and they take a look at the lineup of whatever sport it is, professional sports. Wait a minute, hold it. There's all of these Methodist guys, these Baptist guys, and oh, look, there's some, now anymore, there's Eastern religions represented in the, where are the Jews? Wait, where are the Jews in Major League Baseball, for example? Sandy Koufax, Al Rosen, goodbye. And no, I mean, when you're talking about a disproportionate lack of participation, and a Jewish mom told me many, many years ago, when the other fellows are out practicing, when the other fellows are out playing ball, and that's wonderful, but Maury should be studying and doing his homework. And it isn't because of any reflection negatively about athletic activity. Don't let it take away from homework.
Yeah, as a Jewish mother myself, I have two girls who were never particularly interested in playing football, but I know Jewish mothers who would never let their children put their physical being at risk by allowing them to play football. And my husband often says that at the age of 13, Jewish children have to learn how to read a foreign language written in a completely different alphabet. They have to learn how to study, how to write, how to stand up in front of a congregation and deliver their own insight into a text. It really lays the groundwork for that value of learning.
And you're not saying that ethnically, biologically, Jews are smarter than Methodists. You're saying that the whole concept of study and preparation academically, the emphasis is there.
Yes. I think as well, when we look at root causes of anti-Semitism, there is a natural human need for a scapegoat, for a victim. If we look at the end of World War II in Germany and the foundation of the rise of Hitler, Germany was defeated in World War I. It was a humiliating defeat. There was a tremendous inflation. There was tremendous destruction. And the Jews were a very available target to scapegoat for why this had occurred. And that laid the roots for the tragic of horrors of the Holocaust.
And the Holocaust then yet still, as a result of the recognition simply historically of what happened to Germany, they were defeated virtually as humiliatingly as they were in World War I. So please, if you will, Rabbi Kapel, explain to me why, with no positive elements reflecting any of the things that Hitler left behind, why is there a neo-Nazi movement anywhere in the world? Explain to me, if you can, and please do it in 12 minutes.
Explain, I can't explain. Bigotry, hatred, jealousy. The Jews have historically used the expression of being the chosen people. I think there may be some religious resentment about this idea of who are you, that you does chosenness mean that you think that you are better than everyone else? And I like the way Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan reconsidered that phrase to remind us that we are chosen to have a certain responsibility, not that we are chosen because we are better or more loved than any other people. We are chosen to bring the message and the example of ethical monotheism into the world. And that probably has not been an overwhelmingly well-received message either.
Do you think, though, that a guy with an automatic weapon or a firebomb attacking a synagogue is thinking about the chosen people or what Judaism has meant in the world of banking?
My daughter said to me yesterday that as this situation that we are in right now unfolds and we see some media outlets beginning to turn against Israel, she said, so much for the myth that Jews control the media.
Have you actually experienced elements of media on the side of Hamas?
Yes.
Tell me about it.
I think that we are seeing nationally and internationally many, maybe not many, certainly some voices beginning to say that Israel brought this upon themselves.
These are editorials.
Opinion pieces.
Yeah.
Just justifying the behavior of Hamas, for which there is clearly zero justification. And I think what my daughter's concern was, and many of our concern, is that there's going to be more and more of it.
More assaults on Israel?
More condemnations of Israel, and in particular of Israel's retaliation, because the government of Israel is now having to do what any government would do, which is figure out ways to prevent such an occurrence from happening ever again, and considering if there's any possibility whatsoever of rescuing the hostages, including the American hostages, who are currently being held and subjected to God knows what kind of torture. In fact, I think I heard as of last night that Hamas was threatening to kill one hostage per hour if Israel did not back off from their attacks.
And for every building that was bombed. But you're saying that some news individuals see Israel as the affluent bully.
I think that's well said.
Sadly said. You have achieved individually so much. Colonel, Rabbi, Bonnie, Capel, have you personally experienced anti-Semitism and bigotry?
To a very, very small degree. I would say nothing deeply meaningful and nothing parallel to what's going on now. The rabbi came to Arizona to serve as the rabbi of Temple Beth Shalom, and we did have anti-Semitic, anti-Zionist graffiti painted on that building in Mesa many, many years ago. In the military, I remember sitting for a medical exam and having the person next to me say, oh, now we're going to see some Jewish blood.
Oh.
So some small moments, but nothing really to speak of. I've been very blessed.
When you were a little girl, do you remember being the Jewish little girl?
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York.
Oh, well, pardon me. So that's a brief and total explanation. You're also here, and for all too short a time, an hour of conversation with you about your experiences on a personal basis, your professional experiences, your rabbinical experiences. Allow me to ask you, at this point in our lives, we have in our lifetime experienced that which many said would certainly not happen in our lifetimes, a black president. But still, with all of the academic leadership and with all of the economic directions that Jewish Americans have taken us, with all the successes in all of those fields, no Jewish serious candidate?
is it possible to say Jews are too smart to run, oh, yes. run for that office?
No, here you can say that, yes.
We have a...
Very few Catholics, too, I might want to add.
We do have a Jewish husband of our vice president mm-hmm. now, and I happened to be in Washington, D.C. just last week and had the pleasure and privilege of seeing a sukkah at the White House, so that was very
exciting.
Explain
to our audience what that is.
A sukkah is the symbolic temporary home that Jewish people form for what you might know as the Feast of Booths in the biblical text.
So that's as close as you've gotten, right? The husband of a vice president. That's almost not being there at all.
Don't tell him that.
No, but doesn't it seem strange, though? I mean, when you're talking about the fact that where black Americans have come from that origin place, having been brought here and winding up with a presidency that I think for the most part was considered positive, and yet no Jewish candidate. You're smiling.
God willing, someday it will happen, and I hope that person will be steeped in Jewish wisdom and will be able to turn to the Jewish tradition seriously to help guide them to be a wonderful, wonderful leader for this
country.
So
you can have a bumper sticker then on your car that says, "Don't elect a schlep." You want somebody that you really can be proud of, right?
Yes.
Before we have to leave, and I must tell you, there are times, rarely, there are times when I look and I say, oh, okay, that's it for the hour. I've enjoyed this, fine. But this one, I could carry on with countless additional questions that I think the audience would enjoy hearing the response to. So I'll close with this one, and I don't think it's an easy answer. Israel, a year from today.
Israel, a year from today, will be stronger, will be more united, will be rebuilt, will be a leader in the world as it is now for technology, for human rights. Israel will live and endure and flourish.
Is that also the voice of a colonel rabbi who's also an idealist?
It has been said that you can't be a Jew without being an idealist. To be an idealist is to be a realist.
That's another one of those interesting Jewish answers that I'll take home with me, right, and work on, as I say to Duffy. So this is how Bonnie closed the hour, right? You are optimistic. But are you also optimistic, Bonnie Capel, Rabbi Capel, are you also optimistic about Israel's relationship with the rest of the Middle East that was beginning to really move in some very positive arenas?
I have concerns. This has definitely set the clock back and made it more difficult, which is why I would like to emphasize the incredible importance of the United States of America as a strategic ally for the force for democracy in the Middle East. And I would encourage anyone who feels at all to be an ally of the people of Israel to let your elected representatives know, to support charity that is being collected now for victims of terror. Check out the website of the Jewish Agency for Israel. And we need all the friends that we can get right now.
Am I invited to services?
You are absolutely 100% invited, welcome, and encouraged.
Where shall I go? Tell me where to head.
Temple Chai, 4645 East Maryland Road. That's in Phoenix. We will gather at 6 o'clock on Friday night.
And I'll tell the rest of you to head to the God Show the next time we get together. I'm Pat McMahon.